off the band, and then does a retrace and relocking. It's called lock and roll. It is an extremely stable technique for giving a spectrum analyzer response, but that signal is not phase locked across that screen all the way, only at the beginning of each sweep in this lock and roll process. So the spectral purity of that oscillator already is degrading when you get to 22 gigs, not counting the 30 dB of extra loss of the mixer. So minus 134 without a whopping big preamplifier, no way in hell. Whoever you were talking to didn't know what he was talking about, Mel, and he was throwing it back on your, in your lap, saying that you weren't making the measurement right. Well, he was asking you to do things beyond the laws of physics. Even though it's a quality brand name and an expensive instrument, it can't do that, in my opinion. Over to you, Mel. I'll be amazed if that 22 gigs I think can get down to minus 100 dBm. Over to you, Mel.
Exactly. I think the best I saw was 109, if I remember correct, was 109 dB. I remember that and all. But I understand that on the later instruments, the Hewlett Packard, they are using, I guess now, I think they went to mostly, what, FFT system, Dick, fast Fourier transform, over.
Yes. It turns out the maximum sweep speed you can use on a spectrum analyzer, you would think it's a linear function of bandwidth. It's square law function of bandwidth. In other words, when I go from a 1 meg filter to a 1 kilohertz filter, I made a 1,000-to-1 change in resolution bandwidth of the IF strip. Common sense would lead you to believe, okay, I've got to sweep 1,000 times slower. Uh-oh. You've got to sweep 1,000,000 times slower. When you go from a 1 meg filter to a 1 kilohertz filter, you go down to a 10 hertz filter, and the amount of time it takes you to sweep across that screen is so long that you better be sweeping very little bandwidth. Your span better be a very small number, like you know, 300 hertz or 100 hertz of total span, because you've got to sweep very slowly with a 10 hertz filter. That's because you are sequentially sweeping a filter, and not only does a more narrow filter have a longer time constant for its rise and fall, but because of its bandwidth, it dwells for a shorter period of time in that frequency region. That's part of the reason why it becomes a square law phenomena in sweep speed. When you go to digital signal processing, you're no longer sweeping a filter. If you're spanning a 100 meg region with a 10 hertz filter, you're only scanning across the signal 10% of the time. When you're doing it with digital signal processing, you're scanning across that signal 100% of the time, because the digital signal processing is giving you the equivalent of 10 separate filters of 10 hertz each, all running simultaneously, contiguous filtering side by side. As if you had 10 filters side by side, if you know what I mean, and you're running them all full time. That's what digital signal processing will give for you. The good news is that the very slow sweep speed gets speeded up by, there are times where it gets speeded up by 100 to 1 or 1,000 to 1 on the very narrow filters. That's the good news. The bad news is that when the signal goes up and down in amplitude because it's being modulated, you still have to wait a reasonably long period of time for that signal to show up on the screen through the digital signal processor and tell you that that event took place.
Repeater, timeout.
There's a kind of integration still going on. So digital signal processing on narrow filtering, that combined with variable persistence phenomena of the screen display, these things can all help a lot. But it still doesn't stop some of the problems of super narrow filtering on a spectrum analyzer. Have you used a spectrum analyzer with the DSP for its narrow regions? Enritsu, among other companies, has specialized a lot in that. And there's a disadvantage, which I'll tell you about on the next transmission. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. I haven't used that one yet, the newer version that has the FFT. I understand the great advance is that it's got that store recall system, Dick, the storage system, you know, and the RAM in there, is extremely flexible. They have that, what they call that advanced marker function system, so that the power bandwidth is, you know, signals that marks it at like 3 dB points of a signal, Dick, over.
I was using a Inritsu spectrum analyzer recently, which has got some very nice features to it, and it's quite portable, and it had a flat screen display, a liquid crystal display, and so on. That's the good news. However, I was using it for a program, a project, in which I had to be able to see transient phenomena that would occur in milliseconds and hundreds of microseconds. There were transient phenomena that would happen, which I wanted to see them on the screen in real time. There was just no way I could set the controls on that Inritsu signal generator to do that. I had to go back to an old-fashioned, I guess I was using an 8594. I think it was an 8594 that I went to. I had to go back to a, let's call it a 1985, 1990 type spectrum analyzer, which had a more conventional display, where I could make the display update the screen in milliseconds, and therefore I could catch these transient phenomena, and I would see the flashing on the screen. With the Inritsu, there's just no way I could see it. I was completely blinded from events that were occurring a few percentage of the time, and the events themselves dwelled for short periods of time. On the Inritsu, once in a blue moon, it would catch one of the events. On the 8594, I caught every one of them. I would see the screen flashing at me because I was getting real time. So the modern day digital signal processing, flat screen type, liquid crystal displays, they've got that strong disadvantage. I haven't found one yet that has a mode of operation that'll give me real-time display for the wider bandwidths of display. I think I was using a 10 kilohertz or a 30 kilohertz res bandwidth, and I wanted to see things in fractions of milliseconds, and there's just no way the Inritsu would show it to me, and the Hewlett-Packard, the old-fashioned one, showed it to me very easily, hands down. K2KEY, K2LIW.
2QAQ.
Glenn recognized, but Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Exactly. That's where it is new. I was going to say this new type of display and all. It's a whole new ball game. And I'm not a lover of these new type of displays, these new flat screen displays, Dick. I don't know. I like to look at the old scope. For some reason, I have my scopes and all. I don't look to upgrade them. For only one reason, I still would like to have a CRT, which seems to be literally impossible to obtain anymore. All right, let's Glenn pick it up, Dick, over.
Hey, you got Eric that's drastically in love with cathode ray tubes when it comes to high-definition television display. You got you and me who like cathode ray tube old-fashioned spectrum analyzers where they give me real-time display. If that Inritsu had a connector on the back panel, which was fast video output, which I can put into any other kind of oscilloscope, I would have been happy. It didn't give me that connector. It wouldn't allow me to go to that sweep speed. I couldn't get a real-time display out of that instrument no matter what I did, and it frustrated the daylights out of me. Now, maybe Glenn's got a solution to all this. KC2QIQ, how do you solve real-time problems on modern-day spectrum analyzers, Glenn? K2LIW.
Hey, good evening, Dick. Good evening, Mel, and everybody on the net. I had an interesting experience the last couple of weeks. I've been spending time in the EMI lab and getting a chance to see a mixture of some older and some newer equipment. And one instrument that's really impressed me, I've got to get the model number off of it. I don't know it off the top of my head, but it's made by Rohde & Schwarz. It's a receiver/spectrum analyzer. And so far, I was doing some experiments with it on my own, just looking at some of the capabilities of it, and it does have one of the new modern color displays, and some of the modes I could put that into is absolutely phenomenal. I know that you're familiar with any of the later model Rohde & Schwarz instruments, Dick. I'm going to throw that back to you. And next time I get back to the lab, what I'll do is I will write the model numbers down and you know, some of the capabilities that I've seen it capable of. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, some of the modern instruments made by Rohde & Schwarz and also made by Tektronix, among others, I think Hewlett-Packard may have a version of it. not only do they have a color display, but multiple pieces of information at the same time. I use a Rodenschwart vector network analyzer where I display S11 and S22 simultaneously. One is yellow and one is blue. S22 really means, S11 means reflection coefficient of, say, an antenna, and S21 really means gain of the antenna. I can display the gain and the visor of the antenna simultaneously in real time, milliseconds of update. So as I'm waving my hand or a tuning tool near one of the elements of a Yagi antenna that I'm peaking up at a UHF frequency on a small antenna range on my desk, for instance, I'm getting a real-time display. That's one kind of multicolor. The grid is black. The two displays across the grid are yellow and blue, and the lettering on the grid is red. So I'm using all those colors very nicely. There's another kind of color display you can get with Tektronix Rodenschwarts where probability density is displayed in color. So you've got a noisy signal on screen, and if buried in that noise, there is a repetitive signal, which is there in certain portions of the screen with very high probability. You can make the high probability show up red, and the lower probability blue, and the very low probability black, and so on. So the colors on the screen tell you the probability with which that kind of display is showing up on the screen. Is that what you're saying, Grant? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
Yes, Dick, and among other features that I think is absolutely phenomenal for troubleshooting EMI, one of the features that this receiver spectrum analyzer has is that it can be controlled by software. You can run a program with a local PC, and you can run your scan. Like, I have to run scans for radiated emissions from 30 to 1 meg and in a 10-meter chamber. And then, of course, you have to go in X, Y, Z axes. Now, it runs the scan and measures from 30 to 1 meg in different time frames, so it gives you the peak values, and it will record them, and basically you run the next one and the next one, and basically it overlaps them on the screen. Then you can go back in software and then calculate all the quasi-peak, and what it will do is it will go back to each position and then go back to each area where a peak was close to a spec limit, and you can actually plug in on the computer how much margin you want from your specification. Like, if you want FCC Class B to be anything less than that frequency range of, like, say, 30 dB microvolts, you can go back and it will spot those points where it got close to the spec range and then do a quasi-peak measurement to see how much additional margin you have in quasi-peak. But to do all those calculations, the display that it gives you, the ability to print it out and save it on software, very, very nice way of doing EMI and to be able to troubleshoot, because you can run scans, stop, make a change, go back, and then you can compare the two scans, one right on top of each other. Really phenomenal capability. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Want to see if Kent wanted to say anything? Yeah, Rodenschwarts makes some awful nice instruments. They do an awful good engineering job. Those joinments are all right. when you say quasi-peak, give me a little bit of a definition, Glenn. What is the difference between peak and quasi-peak? Is it some kind of an average peak with multiple spectral overlay? Over to you.
Yeah, I'm probably not the best person to explain this, but generally the peak measurement that's made on the spectrum analyzer is, you know, very similar to what's being measured in EMI as peak. In the sweep, it'll, you know, it's set at like a 9 kilohertz bandwidth resolution, and it sweeps across the band and records it. Now, the quasi-peak is, it's part of an FCC standard. I know what you're looking for, and I'm not sure I've got the correct answer for you, but it's always a number. The quasi-peak is a semi-averaging of the peak, and what exactly it is, I'm really not sure. I know I have it written down someplace in specifications and give you exactly what that calculation is, but unfortunately I can't do it tonight. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I wonder if that quasi-peak could be an RSS, root sum squared, RMS, root mean squared, or something like that. So in other words, I think you're saying the FCC will allow you to go to a peak value. Let's assume now that you're not supposed to exceed, I'm going to pick a number out of you, minus 40 dBmV. And you can hit minus 40 dBmV legally if you do it with a very low probability, if it's one event per hour. Is that sort of what we're talking about here, Eric? I mean, Mel, here we go. Glenn, go ahead.
That's exactly it, Dick. What'll happen is, as long as the density of the signal is very, very light and it's not happening all the time, because, like, typically in these kinds of scans, their power supply EMI radiated in chamber, so you're setting up the loads kind of like outside the chamber. The unit under test is inside, and what you're looking for in all three axes is basically what's coming out of that power supply in terms of emissions in the air in all the axes. Now, you're going to get a peak measurement. But what they'll allow is the density of that signal, in other words, like you're saying. So it's not an RMS. It's something else. And I mean, there's a definite calculation for it. So just unfortunately, I don't have it at the tip of my fingers right now. But next week when I come back on the net, I'll definitely come armed with that, because I know I'm going to be doing EMI all next week as well. So actually, I have to go and sign off. But I did want to mention that wonderful piece of equipment from Rohde & Schwarz. A lot of fun. It makes doing EMI and EMI troubleshooting a lot easier. But back over to you, Dick. KC2 QIQ.
A receiver spectrum analyzer. Do you happen to know the model number of it?
No, I'm going to. I'm definitely going to write it down. I could probably describe it to you knob for knob, but I don't have the model number. But I am going to write it down as well. That's another piece of information I'll bring back next week.
There was another question I wanted to ask you. Oh yes, your electromagnetic interference laboratory. In the old days, was a simple screen room with a copper top table, and you located the device and the test some number of feet from the wall, some number of feet from the floor, and so on, some number of feet from the left and right-hand wall. Craziness. Nowadays, I'd like to believe a much higher percentage of the electromagnetic interference measurements are done in a truly anechoic chamber. It's a screen room with absorbing materials on the walls. Is that true in your case? It's an anechoic chamber, Eric? Glenn?
I know when they do the conducted emissions, they're done in that kind of a chamber. In filter backwards, they do the radiated emissions in an outdoor. Dayton T. Brown has a chamber that looks like a very, very large horn. It's made by a German manufacturer called GTEM. And the only one that has the for radiated emissions, a chamber on Long Island, where you can make those measurements would be Underwriters in Melville, Dick. KC2 QIQ.
Now, you use an Oates range, which is outdoor test facility or something like that. And I think you use the filter location, if you know what I mean by that. I think you and I have already had a conversation on that one, F-I-L-T-E-R. Yes, I'm familiar with the GTEM, which is really it's an extremely large cone with a great big dummy load at the large end, and it all tapers down to a very small a coaxial connector at the narrow end, and anything you put in there, you can measure its X, Y, and Z emissions, irradiated emissions, and that's a fairly nice test, and I've seen a number of those GTEM-like devices, and I think, unfortunately, they only go to a couple of gigahertz, and beyond that, they become unreliable. You said you're going 30 to a megahertz. You kept saying 30 to a meg. Does that mean 30 hertz to 1 million? Or did you really mean 30 megs to 30 gigs? Over to you, Glenn.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's getting late. 30 megahertz to 1 gigahertz. 1,000 megacycles. Megahertz, right? Cycles, boy. That's a blast from the past, right? Back to you, Dick.
Yep. 1 kilomegacycle, as it used to be called. Nowadays, it's called 1 gig. So 30 megs to 1 gig. And that's a very typical freak range. And so if there's built-in switching regulator power supplies and whatever of the instrument under test, I can see how you got to work pretty hard for some of those, because nowadays, many a switching regulator is running at 100 to 500 kilohertz and is running with a square wave, and so it can make some pretty rich harmonics, which sometimes give grief. And the actual machine that you're measuring, is it something that really is capable of emitting an RF signal, or are you just trying to find all of the undesired emissions of its power supplies? Over to you, Glenn.
Oh, boy, I wish it was just as simple as the power supply. The power supply stuff is really just a lot of broadband noise coming from, like, either 75 to 100 kilohertz, main switching that's taking place in the supply. But that stuff, you know, we've got that covered. I mean, that's no problem at all, meaning FCC Class B to a kilowatt. It's a real piece of cake now. But the problem is, the reason I'm spending so much time in the lab right now is we're doing power over the Ethernet, which is basically a running power supplies through Ethernet cables with one of the pairs. In other words, in, you know, basically you have four pairs in a like a Cat5 cable, and we use one of the pairs and we basically send power through it. And, you know, the power level could either be in a couple of different ranges, like, you know, 14 watts, 33, 45. Actually, we have 75 and mega power now, which is up to 95 watts, because we can go up to 56 volts peak on the Ethernet cable and still basically not over dissipate or have too much losses in the cable, and be able to get 95 watts out the other end of a, you know, like a 300 foot cable. It's kind of neat, but unfortunately you have to have detection, and detection means that if you just plug a peripheral into a Cat5 cable, you have to make sure you don't have 56 volts hot on that cable. You have to have some kind of detection device on the other end that determines that the, you know, that it's going to accept power. Otherwise, you'll burn up a lot of equipment. Like if you have a camera that needs power or a VoIP phone, you have to have that handshake detection on the other side. Let me let it drop for a second. And basically from there, with that detection, there's a microprocessor inside there. Now, those things, I'll tell you, boy, it's hard to try to keep a communications port, because you have to communicate to a laptop or some other network and then keep all that digital noise down. And I mean, that stuff has products that goes up into the gigahertz. You got to shield the connectors, shield the processor. Those micros put out so much noise. It's beyond belief. Dick, back to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Boy, that PoE, power over Ethernet, 56 volts peak, 95 watts, that's around 1.7 amperes. Fantastic. And you've got four twisted pairs in a Cat5 cable, and the other three twisted pairs could be carrying all kinds of digital data. Is there any digital data simultaneously present on the 56 volt, 1.7 ampere one, or is that one just pure DC? Over to you, Glenn. By the way, one other question is, the 95 watt version, is that called super overpower over Ethernet? You gave it a name and I wasn't fast enough to write it. Go ahead.
Well, the marketing name that we're using for 95 watts is called mega power. 75 watts is typically called ultra, and the other power levels, like, you know, 33 and 14, those are the standard IEEE standards that are set up already, and those are already governed by the IEEE. These other ones are kind of like additional higher level options that are available, called ultra and mega. Mega 95, ultra 75. And yes, you can send data on top of the on top of the other pair, because there is a little transformer isolating it inside there, so you can actually even send it on top of that as well.
Now, when the data is added on top of the 56 volts, does that mean the 56 volts goes higher, or is it always negative going data, so it's 56 volts has a sudden dropout in order to send data? Because I see the possibility of a peak voltage here that you'd rather not exceed. And that's question number one. And question number two, is the word mega power unique to your particular organization, or is that an industry standard word for 95 watts? Over to you, Glenn.
The other question first. It's decoupled, Dick. So in other words, the data is decoupled, so it's not floating at that. In other words, you have some kind of like capacitive decoupling, but yes, you have to be careful that the data peaks don't exceed 60 volts, otherwise you're exceeding the SELV rating, and you can't have SELV. And also, when you're sending the data over that pair, you may be violating SELV. Also, Ultra and Mega happen to be trade names for a specific company, where the 33 and 14 are the IEEE standards at 48 volts. Back to you, Dick.
SCLV stands for?
Safe voltage to the touch. That's not the exact acronym, but that's what it means. Anything above 60 volts, the safety agencies worldwide pretty much say that's a dangerous voltage to touch by hand. Below 60 volts is considered safe to touch.
That amazes me, because when it comes to the wiring of a rotator outside of the house, to my knowledge, none of them exceed 30 volts. And if 60 volts was allowed, that would mean some of those rotators would have been a lot more efficient. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, like everything else, too, the safety, a lot of the rotator designs that we're probably talking about are antique. You know, I mean, they go back a long time ago. Rotor's been around a long time. And you generally, when something, you know, works, they kind of stick with it for a while. And it's hard to sell a new improvement on top of that, you know, unless, of course, it's a different manufacturer, like maybe Yaesu or somebody comes out with a little bit better rotator. But the old Bell rotators from, you know, CDE from way back when, those things have been, you know, around forever. But, yeah, no, you're absolutely correct. I mean, you could make an SELD device anywhere as long as it's under 60 volts. And you could be very close to it, like we're running 56.
56 plus peak for the data, which you keep under 60. Interesting. When you're running the 56 volts, 1.7 amperes roughly, 95 watts, over a typical gauge of Cat5, which I think is around 22 gauge, but I'm not sure on that one, my guess is you can't get that 95 watts a mile away. What's the maximum range you can get with a Cat5 on 95 watts? I'm going to guess it's something in the vicinity of a couple hundred yards. Go ahead.
Precisely. 300 feet is the rule. And it's also standard also in Cat5. You'll find out that basically without some kind of a additional switch or something else, more than the power being a problem, the data's going to have a problem after 300 feet.
Yeah, some of the Cat5, have you ever used Cat5e or Cat6, I think it is, which I believe can carry 600 megacycle data. You ever use any? You ever see Cat6 data cable? Glenn, go ahead.
Absolutely, because we have to make sure that most of our PoE equipment and switches are capable of gigabit performance.
Yeah, what's nice about the Cat6 cable is that it's got a very fancy piece of plastic holding the twisted pairs such that they have a very defined interrelationship. So the cross coupling between the cables is clearly defined. Have you ever taken apart the end of a Cat5 cable or Cat6 cable and looked at it very carefully, and you see that the four twisted pairs of eight wires have four different twist rates? Have you ever noticed that, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but unfortunately I have. Occasionally one of those cables tends to break or something pulls off the end, and usually my techs are usually the best guys. They're very, very careful with those connectors. Generally, when I'm out there, it's usually because there's a problem of some sort, and I've got to take a look at something, and I'm not as careful as they are, and usually I'm the one pulling the end off that stupid connector. I've got to repair it. Yes, that curse putting it back on again. Back over to you, Dick.
When it comes to the color code, have you yet discovered the fact that there are two separate standards as to what color goes where? Go ahead.
Yes, absolutely, and when all else fails, you use an ohmmeter, you go down the other side and make sure when you're putting the new connector on, and you write it down on a piece of paper and double-check it.
Do you know, I've forgotten, do you know the name of the two standards for the two different color code setups as to how the wires go into the connector?
I don't know them off the top of my head, but you know something, I'll bring that back to you next week too, because it's just one of those things that I never memorize, but I do have all that information in my office.
Yeah, there's a big difference if you're using it as a jumper cable as opposed to a real data cable. There's two different wiring schemes. Crazy stuff, but wire is very good stuff, and they're sending all kinds of high-speed data, video, all kinds of video down these cables. Mel, what kind of mail have we had this week? And let's give it a nice long drop just in case Kent wants to say something. K2KEY with a bit of delay for Kent, K2RIW.
Maybe we have some final from Mr. Kent.
Nope. I think it's you. It's just you, me, and your mailbag, Mel.
Very good. I just would have started to look at some papers here, but I got sort of carry. Oh, here we are. Started to look at them. I couldn't find the sheet. My daughter just called. She said that she listening to the TechNet, and I don't understand the heck of a lot of it, but said they're coming in real great there in Jersey. Let's see. Oh, here's one. Well, I'll take a couple there. We've got a few minutes. My teacher was saying that radiation resistance is close and safe to 377 ohms. Should we make an antenna then that's approximately 377 ohms in heat, Dick, over?
Good question. Good common sense. Absolutely not. And by the way, if Julie's listening, she definitely wants to visit a library or go to a newsstand or whatever and get a hold of the June issue of Scientific American, 2009, June issue. Beautiful article on the exoplanet searches. There, at this instant of time, there are 366 planets that have been discovered, and a lot of them discovered by Hubble, in this universe, 366 planets outside of our solar system. And the uniqueness about the article is that they discovered that these planets are going around. You would think there would only be planets around something that looks like our sun. There are planets going around neutron stars, white dwarfs, brown dwarfs, all kinds of things. They mentioned just about everything except black holes. I don't think they found any planets going around a black hole, but they have found planets going around every other star-like or star stone. In other words, a brown dwarf in some cases is a star that never really had enough material to properly form, or it's the cinder left over when a star finally ran out of all its fuel. They're finding planets around everything. The world is, the universe is filled up with planets. There's a lot of potential for life out there. That's the gist of the article. Rather well done article. So she wants to see the June issue of Scientific American. Now, let me drop and talk to you about 377 ohms. That 377 ohms, how does that number come about? Oh, you could talk about the square root of E0 to mu0. That doesn't communicate to most people. In other words, what's the basic dielectric constant of free space? What's the basic dielectric, the magnetic constant of free space? You put one over the other and take the square root, and you end up with 377 ohms. A more realistic way of putting it is that if I know I'm standing in a spherical room, I've got a 100-watt light bulb in a spherical room, and I've set up things in such a way that the area on the spherical room is 100 square meters. Assuming the light bulb, whether it be a transmitter or a transmitter of light, doesn't matter, a radio transmitter, is putting out 100 watts. Therefore, the room is equally displaced around that light bulb, and it's got 100 square meters of area. There is 1 watt per square meter. That's the power flux density when you're that distance away from a 100-watt light bulb, so that the total area of the room is 100 meters, and you and I could calculate that. Maybe it's a 5-meter radius room, but we could calculate it. When you're that distance away from a 100-watt source, you're getting 1 watt per square meter of what they call power flux density. But you got 100 watts being radiated, 100 square meters of total area, and it's evenly distributed. Obviously, 1 watt is across each square meter. That's a given. Now you go and measure, okay, I got the right kind of instrumentation. I measure volts per meter. Across that square meter, I know there's a watt of power flowing through it, and I measure the volts per meter. I come up with some number of volts. And I know that that number of volts, if it was going through a dummy load, would follow the law E squared over R, power equals E squared over R. I could calculate a number of different ways. I could figure out what is the R, what is the E, what is the current, I squared R, E squared over R, IR. Anyhow, I can calculate, I know I've got 1 watt flowing across the square meter, and I can measure the E field in volts. And I know that the numbers will only come out right if the impedance of that square meter is some number. If it's acting like a resistor or some number, you go through that calculation and you'll find out the number is
repeater, timeout.
You'll find out the exact number is 120 pi, which happens to be 376.9 something ohms. Call it 377. So because you know how many watts are flowing, because you know how many watts you started from and how far away you are and how much area you're talking about. And because you measure the voltage, you calculate what resistor must it be in order for that to work out right. And the answer is 377. So that's the more empirical method of finding out what did Mother Nature really intend for the impedance of free space. That if you make it a pure resistor, that amount of E field going across that resistor, considering it as a fixed, small, lumped, dummy load, even though it's really a resistor spread over that whole square meter, it's a sheet of resistance. And you and I would call it 377 ohms per square. Let me backtrack on that one. If I had a conductive rubber sheet, and if somebody told you it is a resistivity of material of 377 ohms per square, and you can buy scrim material intended for antenna development, you can buy this sheer black netted looking material. It looks like the shears that you put in front of a window when you want to have partial transparency, a kind of I wouldn't call it window shade, but I think you know what I mean, a kind of curtain. There's a kind of a sheer curtain that people call scrim, and they make a material that's dunked in carbon granules, a solution of carbon granules, and dried, and the stuff has a resistivity of 377 ohms. That means if you got one square of the stuff, and it doesn't matter what the size of the square is, it's strange, and if along the top edge you make it a metallic conductor, and along the bottom edge you make it a thin metallic conductor, and you put an ohm meter between the two, you'll measure 377 ohms. The magic about ohms per square is I can start off with that square as one square centimeter, one square inch, one square yard, one square meter, one square mile. It doesn't matter. I make a conductor along two of the opposing edges and measure ohms between the two, and I'll measure 377 ohms. Free space acts like that. That's the way it acts impedance-wise. But there's a catch. And the catch is free space, although it acts like a resistor, and the magnitude of that resistor is 377 ohms, it is not a real resistor. You put 1 watt per square meter across that free space, and the free space will run ice cold. It is not dissipating power. It acts like a 377 ohm resistor, but the power flows through it with no insertion loss. No heating takes place. It doesn't do anything except follow the inverse square law. I double the distance between me and that light bulb. I now get one quarter of the number of watts per square meter. But I'll measure one half the number of volts per meter, and I go through the calculation, it'll calculate one quarter of the power. So it is a kind of mathematical resistor that's got a degree of reality and a degree of imaginary to it. It's a real resistor as far as the way it loads...
Repeater, time out.
It's a real resistor as far as the way it loads down your antenna. It's a real resistor as far as the way it acts when signal flows through it. But it's not a real resistor in that it dissipates no power. It just allows the power to flow through. And free space acts like that number. It's not easy to accept. There's three ways of looking at it. I can take the basic physics of E0 and mu0, divide one into the other and take the square root, and I'll end up with 377. I can do this experiment of 1 watt per square meter and measure the volts per meter and calculate what the resistor has got to be. That's the second approach. And the third approach is, what's the impedance of free space? It's 377 ohms. Why? God did it that way. Which one of those three approaches, and I guarantee there's a fourth approach, which one of them really answers the question for each individual person? That's a very individual thing. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Exactly, this is K2KEY. All right, let me see if I can put it into some other words. Maybe I won't get another email saying, say it again. This, as Dick was just saying, this 377 ohms in space is just a, God made it. I guess that's the best answer. But the first explanation that I would give, of course, is to point out that the radiation of a resistance of the antenna is not really fixed. It could be a number of numbers, and I'll tell you why I say that. If you take a dipole, for instance, let's take a simple dipole, the radiation resistance of a dipole is approximately around 73 ohms at the center. Now, if we start to measure the RF impedance, say, and we start to move off, the center actually is what we call that would be the high current point. And if we start moving, down the antenna to other points, the resistance will change. For instance, if we went, let's say, one third down the antenna, the current would be .866. I think one third down the antenna, the current goes to the of the center over.
The current falls off exactly as cosine theta, where theta goes 0 to 90 degrees. 0 degrees is the center of the antenna, 90 degrees is the tip. So two-thirds would be, 60 degrees. Cosine of 60 degrees is 0.5. So two-thirds of the way down the antenna from the center toward the tip, the voltage, the current that's left is one-half the current. Current falls off as cosine. Voltage rises as sine. And by the way, I want to mention the fact that when it comes to length of dipole versus the impedance it gives you, resistive and reactive component, the so-called antenna technical information is now on the website that records all the words you and I say, Mel. If you go to amateurradio.tv and you want to listen to a past technical net audio playback, there's also a section in there where you can look at a decibel discussion on the TechNet by K2KEY, a Smith chart discussion on the TechNet by K2KEY, a Yagi antenna discussion by K2RIW. So all of that jazz is there on the TechNet website, let's call it. It's not really the TechNet website. It's amateurradio.tv website. And so you can look at the curve of what resistance you get for a dipole when you make the dipole longer and shorter, and you can look at another curve, what is the reactance you get from a dipole when you make it longer and shorter. So as you change the dimensions of a dipole, you can make the resistive component anything from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms. So as you can see, the 377 ain't there in a direct way that you and I can see. And nowhere on the dipole, well, there is a place on the dipole where you could measure 377. And it's probably 85% of the way from the center toward the tip. If you could get out there and make a measurement, maybe you'd see 377. But I don't think that's going to make anyone feel comfortable as to what is the impedance of free space. And there's probably one more way of looking at free space impedance. When you make a microwave horn, and you have a slow taper to the horn, and you're slowly going to end the taper.
And repeater, timeout.
You're slowly going to end the horn somewhere, and you want that signal to jump out of the end of the horn and into free space. Have you tapered the horn where it got larger and larger, and now the impedance is 377, and that's where you end the horn? I used to think that ain't true. I can make a short horn that's small, and I get a small amount of gain. I can make a long horn where the throat is big, where the mouth is very big, and I get a lot of gain. And both of them will give me a pretty good impedance match, so that one doesn't work out the way I wanted it to. So to confirm my measurement, other than the volts per meter jazz and watts per square meter, to confirm the measurement of free space to 377, that's not an easy one. It probably would be a good science experiment for a guy in a technical, in his physics course in his senior year of high school, or maybe his freshman year physics in college. It would be an interesting measurement to make. But the way you make the measurement is going to change the results, and it's not super easy to understand. It's a little more theoretical than real, sort of like an isotropic antenna. Nice mathematical thing, but no one's really built one, so to speak. And yet we know it's a real possibility. K2KEY, K2RIW.
It is K2KEY. Well, what I was alluding to, if we took this dipole and theoretically we get a radiation resistance measured there, which of course we can substantiate, of 73 ohms. And now we started moving from the center out, and we went one-third, not the two-thirds point, just one-third out. I believe that's 0.866 of the current, if I'm not mistaken. And we will have a radiation resistance there at about 97 point something ohms. Let me remember. I can't remember. I used to know these figures, of course, off the top of my head. Now, if we fed the antenna at this point, at the 97.3 ohms, I believe it is, point, and we put the same RF at this point as we did in the center. In other words, we moved it from the center to this point, run the same transmitter. The currents along the antenna will be the same. They will not change. And we will, as it'll be the same as if we fed it at the center. I know it's a little hard to understand. So the actually what we call the free space level of the antenna, the free space, will remain the same. There will be no change. I hope I put that in the right words, Dick, over.
I agree with that one, Mill. You're putting the same number of watts in the antenna, and whether you connect those watts with the right impedance matching device, like 70 ohms, at the center, or one-third of the way out at 90-some-odd ohms with an impedance match, and you put the same number of watts, or out at the tip, where it's nearly 1,000 ohms, you put in the same number of watts with the right impedance match, the antenna will ultimately get the same number of watts. The signal radiated will be the same strength of signal. So the impedance along the dipole is continuously changing. It's going to higher and higher numbers as you go further and further out. That's sort of what you're doing with a T-match or a folded dipole match. It gives you a little bit of a feel for why the impedance is higher with those methods of matching. And maybe this is going to help some people. A simple dipole, when you get down to the nitty-gritty of asking people my so-called puzzle question on this one, and I've done it recently with the chief antenna scientist, the chief antenna scientist of a major company in Illinois, and I asked him that question 2 weeks ago. I can tell he's having a little bit of trouble because I'm asking it in a way that's a bit unconventional from the normal way antennas are taught. The most basic, simplest antenna in the world, invented by Heinrich Hertz, 1867, is a dipole. And if you think a dipole is well understood by antenna engineers today, I can easily say it is not. So when you guys hear about these dipole characteristics that Mel is describing to you right now, and you feel uncomfortable, you're in very good company. K2KEY, K2LIW.
WHYY with a question.
Got a little bit of a, it jumps into my head a little bit of a, more, a little bit more information on this. So since the radiation resistance of an antenna depends on what point along the length of the wire we are looking at, the antenna still will radiate equally well whether that we feed it basically in the middle or we feed it out at some point along the line. And the question was, why do we make this? Shows you that there is no reason to try to match this 377 ohms of free space, because the radiation resistance through the resistance of free space is going to be the same. So there is absolutely no basis other than this is like part of, I could say, the natural occurrence of things. So in other words, there is no reason that we would want to actually have to design an antenna for 377 ohms, because we find that the matching its radiation resistance to the resistance of free space makes no sense, because it still will radiate anywhere along that line that we match that the radiation resistance of the antenna depends basic on what point of the wire that we are matching into. We go to the center, we go 73 ohms. We start out, as Dick says, to the end, it goes to a higher value. And that's the basic line of it. This is nothing magical about the 377 ohms. Go ahead, Dick.
Absolutely true. I'm going to add a little bit to it, but Joe wants to ask a question first. Go ahead, Joe.
Speaking of dipoles, I've heard you mention this a couple of times already, that when the RF current is first applied to the dipole, it has to go back and forth 30-some-odd times before it leaves the antenna, or a signal is left the antenna. How is that actually determined?
Okay. Glad you asked. That dipole has Q. Q has many definitions. One definition of Q is what is the 3 dB bandwidth divided into the center frequency. If the center frequency of my dipole was 144 megs, and if my particular dipole was 70 megacycles wide at the 3 dB points, and I divide 70 into 144, I'd end up with 2. That would be a dipole with a Q of 2. You could say the energy bounces back and forth 2 times before it becomes radiated. Well, a real dipole has got a Q of somewhere between 20 and 30. I forget the exact number. And it's a function of how fat is the dipole. That's one way of looking at it. Another definition of Q is voltage rise at resonance. Another definition is current rise at resonance. I can apply a certain amount of power to my dipole, and I could make it a dipole where I'm feeding it in a gamma match manner, a delta match manner, a folded dipole manner, a T-match manner. Each of those three that I mentioned, you don't have a center insulated. There's a solid piece of wire through the center of the dipole. And I'm feeding it with a delta, a gamma, a T, or a folded dipole arrangement. So I got a solid piece of wire through the center. I have the freedom of putting a ammeter in that center, and I can measure RF amperes for a known number of watts. I calculate it that way. I'll come up with a Q of 20. A third definition or a fourth definition of Q is energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. Only 5% of the energy that you put into a dipole is dissipated on each cycle. You could also measure rise time. Every LCR filter you would ever build has a certain Q, depending on how much resistance is distributed throughout it, either the resistance along the coil or the shunt resistor. Let me drop. So any tuned filter you have ever used, you can put the sharpest rise time RF pulse into it right at the center frequency, and you measure what comes out, and every filter has got a rise time and a fall time when you turn off the signal. That's another definition of stored energy, rise time and fall time. You do all these things with a dipole, you realize it's got a real rise time. The instant you turn on the transmitter, the dipole is not putting out full power. It takes a certain length of time. The dipole is a flywheel. Make believe it's the flywheel, that's the main wheel on your steam engine, and you've got that push rod pushing back and forth and turning that wheel. I can connect the push rod very close to the center, and I'll have a push rod that moves very little, but I have to apply a lot of force to get that flywheel rolling. Or I can put the push rod connection point very close to the perimeter of the flywheel. Now I have a very big deflection, but very little force required. I'm choosing what impedance I feed that flywheel with. But in any case, the flywheel has a lot of stored energy. I have to push on that push rod some number of times to get the flywheel rolling at a good RPM. Or the child on a swing. In general, unless I'm an extremely strong person, I push with small amount of force on the swing, and I have to do that process 10 times before the child is swinging with a reasonably large deflection. There's stored energy there. So dipoles have stored energy. Stored energy means that not all of it is dissipated. If the energy is not dissipated, in the case of a flywheel, it's going around and around. In the case of a dipole, it's bouncing back and forth. The energy is bouncing many times. You can measure it by way of rise time and fall time. The majority of the energy you put into a dipole is stored energy. Very little of it gets radiated on each single pass. I know that's not enough to make it completely comfortable, but I think you see four different ways of looking at it, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y. We're down to 1 minute. K-2-L-I-W.
Okay, very good. That opens a little more on that particular subject. Sheds a little better light on it. Makes it a little easier to understand. Thank you.
In fact, Kent, W-A-5-B-J-B, has a patent on his way of feeding the driven element of a Yagi antenna, which recognizes that it's a flywheel, and he doesn't have to feed it in a thoroughly balanced manner, and the antenna works like a charm. This was TechNet number 1,400 and something or other. I've got the number I wrote down here. 1,246. 73, you all. Mel and I will be back next week. Over to you, Mel, for the ribbons.
This is K2KEY. All right, I'm going to continue with another question that came from the same group, but we'll leave that next week for on a little bit on the 12 dipoles. Okay, good. But thank you all for joining us, and we'll try to back. Thank you, 73. This is K2KEY.
Okay, Mel. Bye-bye for now. I'm transmitting on the 147.375, so that's the way we can come through this repeater. But on the 25 input, it doesn't work right now because the machine's turned off. Bye-bye, you all. KQRIW clear. Yeah, I'm wondering why you came through the 375 machine, but you didn't come through the 85 machine in IM. That's a little bit confusing. Got an explanation for that one, Mel?
I could tell you, but I'd rather not tell you over here, Dick.
Roger, Dodger. Understand.